Hi there, welcome to episode 2 of Clockwork Game Design. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. First of all, I should start off this episode by saying I'm kind of searching for the sort of things that a podcast can address better than the other mediums that I already work in. So, you know, I already write articles and books and I have a video series. And so I want to do something for the podcast that uniquely takes advantage of the format of a podcast, of just kind of listening to a person speak and kind of riffing on a topic. And I think that that's kind of what I would like to hear in a podcast. I think for a lot of the episodes, I'm going to be addressing some concerns and feedback that I've gotten from previous articles and videos. But today, I'm going to be talking about a broad category of problems in video game and board game design circles, in the dialogue that we've been having. Basically today, I want to call today's episode distractions, because I think there's a lot of things that sort of distract us from pursuing truth and better guidelines for design, and which explains why we have really come not very far at all since the early days of game design. Now, I should first mention something that I feel like I have to mention all the time, which is this is an extremely young discipline. 50 years ago, there was no human on Earth who their job was game designer. They were a specialist game designer. That just didn't exist 50 years ago. It certainly didn't exist 100 years ago, but it almost certainly didn't exist at all 50 years ago. Started really kind of existing 30, 40 years ago, a little bit. But a lot of those people who were game designers were actually programmers, or they were like engineers of some kind, or like inventors, or just people who had other careers who, you know, oh, I had this idea to make a game. That's certainly true for people like Alexey Pajitnov, the designer of Tetris, or a lot of those early designers who now we look up to a lot. But at the time, you know, they were just regular guys who got an idea for a game and had the wherewithal to actually make it happen, because computers were at a certain point and they happened to have the skill set required to put stuff together on a computer. So really, it wasn't until the maybe mid-80s, early 90s that we really started getting this class of like specialist game designer. You really started to see that in the Eurogame, like board game space a lot in the early 90s. But, you know, in video games, either way, we're talking about, you know, 20, 30 years ago at this point. So this is an extremely new discipline. So we shouldn't feel too bad about the fact that we haven't come very far, because there haven't been people working on the problem for very long. Sometimes it can feel kind of bad because, well, video games have just exploded and taken off way faster than anyone would have really predicted 20, 30 years ago. You know, bigger than like film and bigger than music and all this stuff. But actually, it's kind of funny. I think that explosion of popularity may have actually made it harder for us to, in a way, I think it makes it easier for us to pursue some deeper truths about how to design things. And I think it also makes it harder. It makes it easier because there are just simply more eyeballs looking at the problem. There's more people working on it. And so there's more of a chance that any of those people will be like starting to ask bigger questions about what interactive entertainment is. And that's the good side. But on the bad side, I think that we also have this weird calcified thing. Like in 1980s, we just got this huge explosion of culture that came out of video games, and we got a whole generation that's just, you know, so enamored with these things, and it kind of like made us stuck. I feel like in a lot of ways we're stuck with that, and we're stuck with D&D, and we're stuck with Mario, and we're stuck with RPGs and a lot of these genres, FPSs, pretty much all the genres that we have and we know today in video games and even to a much lesser extent board games, really just all kind of calcified in those first formative years. And, you know, so now we have kind of this generation that's just so romantically involved in that whole aesthetic and that whole world. And I think that has actually slowed us down a lot. So I'm not really sure if the massive success of video games has aided or hurt the progress of game design, but, you know, regardless, we shouldn't feel bad that, you know, 30, 40 years into the history of game design, we haven't really made a lot of progress yet. That's totally to be expected, I would say. I think we're probably farther along than music was 30, 40 years after the first specialized musician was existed. So either way, so that's something to just keep in mind, is that, you know, it's a new discipline. So we should expect that there would be distractions. So what are some of those distractions? When I say that we're distracted, obviously I'm pointing out that there are problems in current games. And now I've been going into this podcast assuming that people are familiar with my work and my stuff, and I have referred people over to go listen to, go watch 3 Minute Game Design, go, you know, read some of my articles, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I can't be certain that everyone's going to do that. I would like this to be a podcast that everyone can listen to. So I should just quickly mention some of the issues that I think our current video games have, besides the fact that they've sort of been stagnant, which is one I just mentioned. One is that a lot of, and we're talking strategy games here, so we're talking what I consider contests of decision making. So things that have a goal, a very clear goal, and are about making choices that are like ambiguous. You don't know, it's not like a puzzle where it's like, oh yes, that was the right answer. Boom, solved. It's more like that was a incrementally better answer than last time you gave, or this is a slightly worse answer and things are a little bit unclear, and then there's a win or loss condition at the end. That's a very quick and dirty way to understand what I mean when I talk about strategy games, which is what I focus on. That's what my books are about, and that's what I'm generally talking about. But I do, you know, a lot of these problems affect all kinds of video games. So one issue with a lot of strategy games is they're just highly, highly random. Magic the Gathering probably being an awesome example. But, you know, even there's other kinds of randomness, like execution really is randomness at the highest speeds when you have like, you know, two tenths of a second to make a decision and you try to make some crazy input and it just, your hands just don't do it. That really is kind of comes down to a form of randomness. And I talk a lot about that in some of my other works, which you can look up. The episode on execution and 3 Minute Game Design is probably a pretty good start there. Either way, we have very highly random games. Hearthstone, even stuff like League of Legends is really quite random, because there's random criticals, strangely enough. When we talk about single-player games, it gets a lot worse. Roguelikes are highly, highly, highly random, like really unfair random, where you'll just get some amazing item in the first, 10 minutes, and then you're just like cruising forever, or some games you just get no breaks at all. Totally random, totally unfair. A lot of games like that, or you know, things that seem a lot more strategic, like XCOM, for example, people kind of take that, or Civilization. People take those two games as like very serious tactical strategy things, but they have dice rolls all over the place and not really a lot else going on besides the dice rolls. Like the dice rolls are kind of largely deciding a lot of stuff. So my point is that this randomness is one of the problems that I see in games. Too much content is something I talked about a little bit last time with the asymmetry episode. You know, just this philosophy of you can just perpetually add to a system. I really think that there's an ideal amount of content for any system, and we routinely just blow right past that, probably in the first, you know, but way before the game even comes out. But certainly if not, you know, after with the DLCs and all that stuff, forget it. We're just way beyond the point of too much content. I would just say that, you know, right now we just have these kind of noisy machines, very much relying on the toy thinking that I talked about last time, to work. You know, it's just kind of a big box of toys, and we have to kind of, a lot of the responsibility gets put onto the player to figure out, well, how are you going to make this fun? How are you going to make this work? And so that's sort of how video games have survived, I think, so far, and have how they've been going. And a lot of people are fighting to continue that. And, you know, the thing is, it's I think that, like I said, a lot of that is romance for people's childhood and maybe a little bit of like a lack of imagination, a lack of being able to imagine that things could be dramatically better. And, you know, but the thing is, we're always going to have toys. We're always going to have these big grab bag things. It's just that my goal is not to eliminate those from existence. So you will always be able to play your huge, you know, Magic the Gathering. Magic the Gathering is not going anywhere. But I do think that it would be really nice if we had some alternatives, if we had some things that were elegant, deep, not wide strategy games. I say deep, not wide. I'll quickly dive into what that means. Depth is like, you know, emergent complexity. So you have 10 elements in your game, whatever they are, cards or something, and each of them can do all this stuff and synergize with all these things and create this deep web of interactive possibility space. So that's like depth. That's what depth is. Go is probably a great example of depth. And then you have width. Width is more like every element is extremely shallow, but there's a billion or like 10,000 elements. Magic the Gathering is the perfect example of width, because every card, there's not like a whole lot you can do with an individual card, and there's not a whole lot of synergy card to card. It's mostly pretty flat, but it's just that there's so many kinds of cards that you kind of get this wide but shallow thing going on. And that's another thing that I talk about in 3-Minute Game Design. So yeah, I talked in the last episode about toy thinking and how toy thinking is kind of really holding us back a lot. Another thing, though, that's a little interesting is this idea of like language and how we talk about games. And I definitely run into this a lot. You know, there's kind of a meme on the internet about talking about the definition of the word game. The meme kind of goes like this, like, oh, everyone's always talking about the definition of the word game, and it's so boring and so stupid and totally futile. And at the same time, let me hereby declare that the real definition of game is any interactive system. That's exactly how the meme goes, like in completion. So let me just say that one more time. The entire discussion of what is a game is stupid. And also, here is my claim about what a game is. And then they go on to say, almost always, that it's any interactive system. So that's a very common meme. Either way, you'll definitely get the first half. Even if you don't get the second thing, you'll definitely get the first thing, which is the whole conversation's stupid. We shouldn't have this conversation. It's really dumb. I see a lot of resistance to the conversation of, you know, to the exploration of, you know, how we could possibly maybe map ideas to words a little bit in a more useful way just for game designers. And now, to be fair, there are people who are insecure and try to use definitions in a sort of propagandistic way. You know, there's people who they don't like Gone Home because it's not Counter-Strike. And so their way of trying to insult Gone Home is to say it's not a game. And that's obviously not remotely useful. And it's like kind of the opposite of what I want to do. What I wanted, because actually what that does is that makes things less clear, because, you know, someday some game arty game that's not really like Counter-Strike comes out and they like it and they do call it a game. You know, it's not, you can't use what you like as the criteria. We're never going to have any connection if that's how we're making our definitions. So we have to create definitions that really kind of reflect something about the nature of interaction. But that's my opinion anyway, and I've been working on trying to do that for a few years now. But this is kind of, it's funny. This is a conversation that's been going on for a very long time. I was looking at just recently this article from 2002 by Greg Kostikian, who's a pretty well-known game designer, and it's called I Have No Words and I Must Design Toward a Critical Vocabulary for Games. And now he's not the first person to write about this, and he hasn't been the last person to write about this. People do write about this every few years. But it's interesting because, well, first off, in the article, you can read this online. It's all over the place. Just, you know, Google it. I'll link to it in the show notes. But one of the first things he does is he talks about Chris Crawford and his book, The Art of Computer Game Design, which I also am kind of a fan of. It's one of my favorite books on game design. And he, and in that book, he actually does contrast games and puzzles, which is cool. And actually, a lot of people have drawn comparisons to my, from my work to Chris Crawford. And indeed, I was definitely inspired a little bit by him. There's definitely some differences. So let me just read like a little excerpt here. This is from Greg Kostikian's I Have No Words and I Must Design. Back in 1982, Chris Crawford published what remains one of the few decent books published about game design, The Art of Computer Game Design. In his book, Chris Crawford contrasts what he calls games with puzzles. Puzzles are static. They present the player with a logic structure to be solved with the assistance of clues. Games, by contrast, are not static, but change with the player's actions. So yeah, I like that, you know, it has that solved, not solved sort of aspect. It's not as highlighted as I would make it. To me, that's a really huge thing that I always say, is that puzzles are designed to be solved. Games are designed not to be solved. So going on with the piece. Some puzzles are obviously so. No one would call a crossword a game. But according to Crawford, some games are really just puzzles. Zork, for instance, the game's sole objective is the solution of puzzles, finding objects and using them in particular ways to cause desired changes in the game state. There's no opposition, there's no role-playing, I don't know where that comes from, and there are no resources to manage. Winning is solely a consequence of puzzle solving. So this is good, but I he is sort of getting a little off in the weeds, because he hasn't clearly... The problem was that a clear distinction was never really drawn between games and puzzles. Basically, the problem here is that they kind of clearly defined puzzle, but they never clearly defined game. So puzzle is a thing that needs to be solved, but games are, quote, not static, change with the player's actions. So kind of unclear. And so I think what really happened here is that puzzles got kind of well defined, but games didn't. And so it's funny, actually, in colloquial speech, I think actually the word puzzle is, you know, people kind of know what you mean when you say puzzle. There's a few exceptions there, but overall, puzzle is kind of a distinct category, a little bit. There's one exception, but I won't get into it right now. So my point is that this article, which was really kind of influential and informative, really doesn't do what it should do, in my opinion, which is kind of like actually define some terms. I mean, the whole article is about how we need clear, good terms. I have no words and I must design is the concept for it. And, you know, that's a really great mission, but he sort of doesn't do it. And the thing is that, you know, Greg Kostikian, like all of us, sort of started out and actually worked in RPGs. He worked in the world of tabletop RPGs largely for a lot of his career and other highly thematic games. And so I think it was difficult for him to actually make the kind of destructive calls that would be required to make a clear definition for some of these words. So it's funny, I think Greg Kostikian is actually a pretty good microcosm of what happened more generally in the games, game design discussion world. Just to move on kind of from the language problem. I mean, the language problem is huge. We won't get anywhere until we kind of solve that. I don't really see a lot of progress being made there right now, but, you know, there are a couple people who are kind of talking about that. I have to mention Richard Terrell, who is one of the people that I know is actually working on game language. And so I'll probably link to him in the show notes as well. But there's very few people actually working on that problem, which is sort of sad, because it's going to be difficult to move on or to get anywhere without that ingredient. Another thing is that's difficult for people is, you know, I'll prescribe guidelines and, you know, it doesn't matter what I say. People are going to imagine those guidelines just sort of slapped onto existing games. And that never works. And that's not going to work for any good guideline. Like the guidelines that we're going to be working with in 50 years just wouldn't work at all on the games that we're making right now, because there's just going to be an entirely different framework. There's just going to be an entirely different, you know, paradigm for design. And you can't just slap on some any of the stuff that I talk about, any of the guidelines I suggest, like last time I was talking about forced random asymmetry, you can't really just slap that on to like League of Legends. That just won't work. So, you know, but people really have trouble with the concept. Even if you tell them that up front, it doesn't really matter. They still are kind of thinking about that in that way, and it sort of stonewalls them from really moving beyond, from really considering the guideline the way that they otherwise would. And I can understand that. I mean, it requires a certain kind of abstract thought. You know, it's funny, my work, I think, tends to resonate more with board game designers because they're used to thinking about things in very, like, bare, abstract terms, like, very disconnected, non-thematic, you know, systemic kind of ways. And when they're designing a board game, they really are kind of, a lot of them, are thinking sort of more from the ground up than video game designers tend to be. So for them, they can imagine, they have more of a clean slate, and they can kind of imagine when I say something like forced random, they can be like, okay, yeah, you know, I get that. Like, it's kind of like the openings of like Puerto Rico or something, or plenty of games that actually do force random in board games. In fact, a lot of my ideas are not that crazy when you hit the board game world. It's really the video game world that presents the biggest resistance. Another distraction would be just the resistance to the very idea, the very concept of something even being better. That's a huge conversation that we have to have. You know, like, I obviously, a professional artist who has been working for 30 years makes, you know, let's say at least slightly better drawings than a five-year-old, right? That's an extreme example. But I think that that extreme example shows us that there are some, like, objective criteria to what makes something good art and what makes something, you know, good writing or good filmmaking or good game design. And, of course, if we don't agree on what those criteria are, there's a lot of wiggle room there for disagreement, absolutely. But I'm not saying everyone needs to agree with my criteria. Of course, I think my criteria is good, and I would like try to convince people about the value of my criteria. But I think what people object to is not my specific criteria, but the very idea of criteria. People have this kind of like postmodern anti-reason idea of anything anyone likes. They don't have to have any explanation. It's just like, that's what they like, and shut down an entire conversation. Can't be explored. There's no explanation for why people like what they like. The whole, there's no accounting for taste concept. But, you know, I mean, obviously there is accounting for taste. We do see trends in what people like. People do actually predict what people are going to like to some extent. And, you know, people do build frameworks for how to do things well. And that's how music has gotten so much better. 20th century music is just a million times better than 17th century music, that by anyone's metric, pretty much. And that's what happens. That's just kind of how it operates. Art is like any other technology. It's communication technology, and it advances because we get better guidelines, we get better criteria, and that's just how things happen, regardless of like what anyone says. That's just, it is how it is. But people have a big resistance to that, and so that's another obstacle. Another thing is that I think that actually, going back to the big explosion of computer games, I think a big thing that held us back about that is that we really could just rely on the advancement of technology. Basically, we were just relying on, you know, computer programmers and engineers and hardware developers to give us the next generation of game design, really. I mean, the, you know, game design from in the early 90s was the same as game design in the late 90s. It's just that we could show more polygons, or polygons at all, for that matter. You know, or then, and you know, things like the Wiimote, or things like, obviously, the king of all of these is probably the Oculus Rift, or virtual reality in general. All these sort of tech gimmicks, you know, 8-bit, 16-bit, blast processing, all this stuff, whether it's technological, whether it's graphics technology, or whether it's little doodad helmet cables that you plug in and you have to spend $250 on it, and it kind of, like, totally sucks, but it's really weird and different. But you're playing, you know, Super Mario Brothers again, but now you're just wiggling a Wiimote around the screen. Those kinds of things, those gimmicks, have kind of taken the place of game design. Those have sort of sufficed. We haven't needed to come up with new actual interactive concepts, because we just come up with new input devices and new ways to display graphics. So I think that the boom of computer technology, weirdly enough, you would think that would, like, open the gate for game design, and it did, but it also was so spectacular that no one noticed the open door for game design. I often talk about how on an Atari 2600, you know, you could have designed Smash Brothers. You could design so many of the things that exist with that level of technology. So if we get to even, like, an NES or something, forget it. You can do, like, just about anything in terms of interaction, you know, in terms of actual rule set building. And it was just a matter of someone had to think of the concept. But there was just, you know, tech gimmicks were so effective at capturing everyone's attention that no one really thought they had to come up with new ideas for actual interaction. And of course, that's a little bit of an overstatement. Some people did, for sure. But I would say that all in all, the whole gimmick thing is definitely something that probably held us back more than anything else. Now, I mentioned VR briefly. I definitely need to do... I think that this format will work well for me with talking about virtual reality. In short, I will probably do a whole episode on this, but in short, virtual reality is, like, totally irrelevant to the field that I'm interested in, which is the field of interactive systems design. Because, okay, you really feel like you're there. So what do you do? Like, that doesn't help us at all with the question of what do you do? You're in the same situation that you are in your living room. And, you know, now people have all these things like, oh, I'll jump off a building, I'll do all this, and I'll do all this. And I have answers to all that stuff. My for now, I will, you know, a little teaser for a future episode on VR. I don't think VR presents anything of a boon whatsoever to game designers. Now, it's not to say that people won't design great games using VR. They certainly can, but they also can design great games using cards and any other components. So, you know, any technology, you know, computers, I think, are fantastic for game design. In fact, I another episode I could do is one on how I kind of actually think that computers are maybe almost a requirement. And I say almost a requirement for good strategy game design, because cardboard and paper and the components we use for those kind of things are too limiting in a very specific way. Either way, those are just a couple of teasers, sort of off topic a little bit. So yeah, these are just some things that have kind of kept us back. I also wrote down something about programmers and how... you know, programming is very hard to learn, and it's its own discipline. I've struggled with it for years and years and years. I've only recently, in the last few years, I'm at this moment, I'm, like, kind of getting over some humps that will allow me to actually, you know, build prototypes myself. I've always relied on programmers to help actually put stuff together in the past. I kind of taught myself to program a little bit on Oro and with help of some friends and stuff, but either way, my point is programming is this massive discipline. And, you know, it's like the people who are good at game design aren't necessarily programmers and vice versa. And in fact, I tend to find that programming is such a big deal that, you know, it's like people can almost barely ever even see through the programming to the game design questions. I see so many people making games, game developers, quote unquote. Whenever you see game developer, it's almost always just a programmer who really isn't, like, making game design decisions. I mean, they do, but they're kind of like surface level. They're not like deep systemic things, and they don't like, they're not going to like throw out half their system, you know, because they realize that some horrible design flaw. They're really just trying to like reach the finish line. Most people are just trying to reach the finish line in making a piece of software that's like a video game. And, you know, just most programmers aren't game designers. And I can't really speak for whether the opposite is true, but I would kind of guess that there's a lot of people that are thinking about game design a lot, and but like maybe don't have access to that programming tools, that programming ability that would let them actually realize their what they have in mind. So, you know, that's a weird thing. And, you know, programming and game design have a weird relationship that's another podcast episode right there. Overall, you know, I'm definitely optimistic. It doesn't sound like it, but I, you know, progress happens, and with or without me or anyone else, progress is going to happen. Anyone else in particular, I mean, and so I'm not concerned. I'm very excited, actually, for the kinds of games that we'll be playing in 10 years. I do think we've already seen some progress, and I don't think that we have seen no progress. But I do think that the more we can work on these distractions, the more, and sort of identify them and kind of call them out when we see them and kind of unpack them and, you know, things like toy thinking, unclear language. You know, if you're fighting people on Reddit or in a forum, just try to like make sure everyone is talking about the same thing. That's all prescriptive language really does is just make sure everyone's talking about the same thing. Otherwise, what's the point of having the conversation? You're just talking past each other. You know, these kind of like everything is just an opinion people, definitely call them out. Try to, you know, point out the most basic obvious things that everyone would agree on and move from there, like the five-year-old to the master painter. I would say also, you know, maybe just try to be more sensitive about tech gimmicks and try to like inform your friends about how, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, you wiggle a thing around, but you're still playing Mario. That kind of stuff. I think that, you know, we can all kind of make a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of difference just by having conversations about these kind of things with each other. So I would recommend that. And with that, I would say we're pretty much running out of time. And thank you for listening to this second episode. Please let me know what you think of it. And I will be definitely very responsive to whatever people tell me about these podcasts because, you know, I mean, I've done a couple of podcasts before, but this one is kind of a weird experiment, and I really don't know if this is something that people value or not, so just let me know, and thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Thanks for listening.